Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Ngā mihi nui. I'm Alison Balance and welcome to this Our Changing World podcast from RNZ. Last week we heard about the importance of strong social relationships in helping us have a healthy old age. Being able to get out and about is an important part of that, whether it's walking, taking the bus, driving or something else. Issues around transport and older people really interest Rebecca Brookland at the University of Otago. She's had several Health Research Council grants looking at older drivers. So I flew, drove, and then walked to her office in Dunedin to find out more.
Transport, it's such a huge area of everybody's life. How we get from A to B and how we get there safely is where I come to it with young drivers. But with older people, it means so much more than that. For older people, their ability to connect with their communities and engage in what's happening is critical to their quality of life and their connection.
And their sense of independence as well.
Definitely. That comes across for young people and old people. What driving represents is a substantial amount of independence and the ability to decide what you want to do and when you want to go to places is huge for a lot of people. It's a facet of our lives, I guess, we take for granted until it's no longer an option. And so for older people especially, once they move into their later years and their health can start to deteriorate, and we're very much a car-centric, car-dependent society, the impacts of no longer being able to drive can be huge on people's quality of life and can lead to depression, social isolation, and in some cases, early move into rest home care. And some studies have shown premature mortality associated with driving cessation. The impacts are large.
So when we talk about older drivers, do we know how many there are out there?
Yeah, we do, and they are a growing population. So back in 2001, there was about 41,000 people over the age of 80 who still had a licence, and they represented 1 in 3 people over 80. And by 2016, that number had more than doubled to 91,000 people over 80 that still had their licence, and that represented 1 in 2 people over 80 are still licensed to drive. So they're a huge demographic, and a lot of them will be still driving really well and really safely, and they'll continue to do that into their 90s for some of them.
Do we have any idea what the oldest driver has been?
I can tell you from our study, we've got some drivers that are 96 in our study, but I think there's drivers in New Zealand that are over 100.
What would be a perfect world in terms of people's mobility?
So there's a concept called optimal mobility, which is this idea that people can go where they want to go, when they want to go, and how they want to get there, which doesn't necessarily mean it has to be car dependent. It's just about having options available that are accessible to people. So we are moving towards some alternative transport options with automated vehicles. They are a long way off, and probably in any scale that are going to make significant changes, we're decades away. But the idea of transport, and it's not necessarily public transport either, because people with mobility issues have issues around accessing public transport and being able to manage them. But if we had systems in place where people could get picked up and dropped off when they wanted to and where they wanted to, and also have assistance with their packages and manoeuvring around places like hospitals. So it's sort of a wraparound support system to help people get to where they need to go.
It could be better pavement so that people who might use a walker, for instance,
it's can... All of those things integrated, and that's where it gets very complex, because it's not just transport policy, it's urban planning as well, and then it's the health systems and accessing those services. And we know from the literature and some of our early findings that for people's transport is being picked up by families and friends. So we're still, even though they're no longer able to drive themselves or drive as often as they wish to or under, you know, at night and things, it's predominantly being picked up by partners and families. And that works when you've got people who live near those support networks. But as we become you know, more spread from our families, or we have more people ageing in place, those options aren't there for everybody. And we also have families who, quite a lot of them are kind of in the sandwich generation, where they are caring for older parents and still caring for their own, you know, teen, early adult family of their own. So they're very stretched.
Well, let's just stick with driving for a minute. Mm-hmm. So as we get older, what tends to be a typical trajectory? So you get to your 60s, you're still completely onto things, you're happy to hop in your car and go on a long holiday perhaps. Then what starts to happen?
So you could still be like that at 90. Like, it's really not aged base. So we're quite careful to make it clear that we're not about taking licences away from people or stopping them driving based on age, which is why New Zealand moved away from an aged base driving assessment process back in 2006.
And so now, remind me what happens now?
Yeah, so now when you get to 75, you go to your GP primarily and get a fitness to drive medical certificate. So that's an in-room consultation. And then when you're 80, that happens again, and then every 2 years after that. And the GPs have some different options. So you can just, they can pass you straight away, or they could refer you to have a driving test if they think that you might need it. Or there's also OT, driving-related assessments, which are more thorough and can look at things around vehicle modifications if needed, so people can still continue to drive.
And do you know anything about when people stop driving? Is it something that they are choosing themselves to stop, or their doctor is basically going, no, I don't think you should be driving?
So it's, once again, it's really diverse. We know from our former driver study, it's a mixture. Most of them chose when to stop driving, but for some of them it was an abrupt, something's happened and they've had to stop, or it's been a gradual decline in ability or an awareness that they're just not as confident or as comfortable as they were previously, and so they come to that choice. It does vary quite a lot. The literature does show us that females are more likely to stop driving on their own, whereas males are more likely to probably need a little bit of a motivator to stop. And that, we don't know why that is. It's the same with driving anxiety. Females report higher levels of driving anxiety than males. And we hypothesise that possibly that might be something to do with what it means to have your licence. And particularly for previous generations or older generations of males, where having a driver's licence was a huge part of self-identity.
Well, such a rite of passage when you're a teenager.
Yeah, and the current older females haven't driven as long as the men. You know, they've come to licensing or driving later, generally. So the older drivers coming through in the next 10 to 20 years, the females will be more similar to the males because they will have been licensed all their lives and very reliant on a car to get around. So it'll be quite interesting to see what those changes mean as well.
I'm thinking of older people that I know, and what happens over time tends to be that they venture less far afield. You know, they tend to stay closer to home, and it might be what they used to go to the doctor just around the corner. Mm-hmm. They pop out to the local supermarket. They go to have a coffee with a friend.
Yeah. So we call that a version of self-regulation. So people recognising their capabilities and managing it in terms of their driving, so that it gives them the option to continue to drive to some places anyway, rather than just abruptly stopping and then having to have all those needs met by somebody else or some other way of transport. We don't understand a lot about self-regulation in terms of how conscious those decisions are and how it relates to when they do ultimately decide to stop driving, which is partly what we're going to look at in our larger project.
So tell me a bit more about the project.
These are two Health Research Council of New Zealand funded projects. The first one started in 2015 and it has three studies within it. So there's the GP fitness to drive assessment study, which I've mentioned. There's a component just looking at former drivers and trying to understand what their transport needs are and how they're meeting them and what mobility issues they're having. And then the bigger project, we recruited from the electoral roll a sample of older drivers, 65 years and older. So we have 1,181. And their family members, if they had somebody that we could interview. It's a nationwide sample, so there's 675 family members as well. So we've done those baseline interviews with those older drivers and family members. And it's around, basically, what are their transport practices? Where are they going? How often are they driving? Have they started to think about driving sensation or made any plans for that? And also some of their baseline health and wellbeing measures. Because the idea is, so with the new project we've just had funded, it's a follow-up study. So we're going to go back to those older drivers and family members next year. So it'll be 2 years since we went to them the first time, and then 2 years after next year, so 2021, we'll go back again. So we're going to try and follow their progress over time in terms of their driving, how it changes, things like self-regulation, does it change over time? Some of them will give up driving. We want to understand the circumstances around that, abrupt or gradual, how they're coping with that, the impact on any health and wellbeing outcomes, particularly interested in the social health outcomes, so which comes where social isolation and depression particularly come into play. Yeah.
I'm imagining there might be quite different patterns for people, say someone who lives in a small rural town versus someone who lives somewhere like Auckland. Mm-hmm. So Auckland, there's a lot of traffic, which I imagine would be quite intimidating for an older person, but then there's probably also more public transport options there, whereas in the small town, the roads are a bit quieter, and if you didn't drive, there's really no other way of getting around.
Yeah, so that's also what we're hoping to be able to look at in more detail. With having a nationwide sample, we've got to be able to look at some of those rural-urban differences in terms of access to other transport options, but also in terms of the roading environment and how that changes people's ability to cope with driving, because it's quite a different challenge in those two different places. But then you have high-speed roads in a rural area, which can also be quite challenging, and lots of potential trucks and things on narrow roads. We're also interested in older Māori and their transport and mobility needs. So just over 15% of the cohort are Māori, and just over 50% of older Māori live in semi-urban or rural areas. So they live in quite remotely from public transport. So it's quite complex, I think, would be the best way to sum it up.
But ultimately, we need to keep people mobile and out and about so that they can socialise.
Definitely. We certainly don't want people giving up before they need to. Driving anxiety is something that can be worked through and managed. You don't want it to be the precursor to someone stopping if they don't really need to. Same with vehicle modifications. You know, if someone's having trouble getting in and out of a vehicle, that doesn't mean they can no longer drive. It just means that maybe they need to look at having a swivel base put on their seat, or something done with their mirrors so they don't have to turn their neck so much. So from that point of view, as long as people are safe, we want them to continue to drive, especially when we have few alternative transport options. But also second to that, most people at some point will get to the point where they can no longer drive to all the places they want to go or drive at all. And so we want people to actually think about that. What does that look like? Like, I think about retirement and I think about where I might live, but do you think about transport in that? Very little people, especially certainly we're finding in our work, given any thought to planning for no longer being able to drive. And it's partly a denial. Don't want to think about it, but also it's just not really on people's radar.
And then sometimes new things come along, and I'm thinking about sort of older members of my extended family, and electric bikes have revolutionised their retirement.
Mm-hmm. And Lime scooters, maybe, I'm not sure. And so this is the other thing. Like a lot of older people, after the car, their next mode of transport is walking. Walking for an older person comes with a lot of issues as well and can actually increase their risk of injury, whether it be a collision with another vehicle or a cyclist or a scooter rider or by falling with uneven paving. So it's about looking at the whole system and how it caters for an ageing population.
But on the plus side of walking is you get some health benefits from that as well.
Yes, most definitely, yes, most definitely. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that sometimes strikes me when I'm out walking is at traffic lights and pedestrian crossings. Some of those pedestrian crossings have quite short crossing times, mm-hmm. and I watch older people who can walk a little more slowly struggle to get across the road in time.
Yeah, it's a very unfriendly environment for anybody that's got any mobility issue, regardless of age, is what I would say about those systems. And that partly comes back to how we view ourselves as road users and this idea that the car is the dominant vehicle on the road and it has the precedent over everything else. I think we're getting a shift in that mindset, that actually they're shared spaces and that we just need to be more accommodating for everybody, not just older people, but all road users.
Yes, it's been interesting because I come from Wellington, where they've just made some reasonably major changes to our bus system. And some of the things that I don't think are particularly friendly is I've seen bus stops that used to be right in a shopping centre moved several blocks away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so from an infrastructure point of view for running the buses and how the services link up, it possibly works better. But for the users, and we want to encourage people to use public transport, they those systems won't work for everybody.
Tell me about some of the things we could think about in terms of how we design our cities and people moving around in them.
So if we're thinking about public transport, so many people can still make use of public transport once they can no longer drive. But we need to think about the location of the start of those public transport systems from where people live and how do they get there. So if they have to walk from their home, it may all be up or down a hill, one way or the other. And even if it's more than 100 metres or a couple of hundred metres, that could be enough of a barrier to make it inaccessible for people. So there's this concept called moorings, which basically is essentially meaning having things like seats along the walking paths towards public, well, between public transport, so people can stop and take a moment to rest, gather themselves up and then carry on again in their journeys. It also gives a set place where people can socialise, because people naturally congregate to where there's a resting place. So that can have an added benefit of some social contact for people as well.
Thanks, Rebecca. And Rebecca Brookland is a research fellow in the Department of Social and Preventative Medicine at the University of Otago. I'm Alison Balance, and this Our Changing World podcast first aired on RNZ on the 15th of November 2018. Online, we live at rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. You'll find this story there, the audio as well as a written feature and useful links. There are also podcasts. They are free and they are in all the usual places that podcasts live. Other current RNZ podcasts to look out for are Black Sheep, which is about New Zealand history, the suffrage podcast Beyond Kate, and 2 Cents Worth, which is a weekly chat about things to do with business and the economy. You'll find us on Facebook and Twitter at RNZ Science. Thanks for listening. Bye for now. Mā te wā.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.